All right, next matter we have on calendar is docket number 64594, Las Vegas Sands versus Soon. Are we ready?
Ready, Your Honors. Steve Morris and Alan Dershowitz on behalf of Las Vegas Sands Corporation. I'm on the briefs. Mr. Dershowitz will be arguing this morning in accordance with our information we gave to the court.
Okay. Chief, I have a disclosure I'd like to make before we begin argument. There's always a lot of sensitivity around this case, but I want the parties to know that I co-authored an article about the Court of Appeals for the Nevada Lawyer with Mr. Smith here. I don't believe that provides a basis for my disqualification. It was an educational article about the statistics concerning the performance of the Court of Appeal in 2015 for the benefit of the Bar Association.
Okay. Thank you. Are you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Alan Dershowitz on behalf of appellants. Thank you, Your Honors, for accommodating my physical needs. This second appeal from the retrial of the case raises fundamental questions about the relationship between this court and the Nevada trial courts, which this court supervises. The basic question is whether the trial court on remand was at liberty to disregard the mandate of this court and the law of the case established in Suen 1 and permit the plaintiffs to present a case that was dismissed on summary judgment, abandoned, and not appealed.
Now, it's with those findings, as you make that assertion, because that is, you're correct, one of the critical issues, was the order of the court very specific as to the parties? And that's one of the inconsistencies possibly in there of not indicating dismissed as to specific issue.
Well, what happens, the trial court dismissed the contract claim against Round Square and also against Suen, and then stated that Round Square is now out of the case. And the case was litigated throughout on the assumption that there was no issue presented by Round Square regarding Quantum Merowet. At the bench memo that was filed in the case, they said to deny Suen standing would preclude any other member of his group from ever being paid for the benefit conferred on Las Vegas Sands. And repeatedly they said it was only Suen as an individual, Joint Appendix 57, Suen's Quantum Merowet claim, 56, Suen is the proper person to pursue a Quantum Merowet claim. And so at the first trial, everyone recognized that Round Square was out of the case on the Quantum Merowet issue, and indeed out of the case. And indeed, the attorney for Las Vegas Sands made without objection the following statement: Round Square is not part of the Quantum Merowet claim on behalf of others. And then plaintiff's lawyers said, we have tailored all of our proposals to you based on your earlier ruling that Round Square is out of the case. So the dismissal of all claims, including Quantum Merowet against Round Square, was a final appealable ruling. They then made a strategic binding decision to put all their Quantum Merowet eggs in one basket and not to appeal that ruling, not to request a remand on that claim in order to maximize. Remember, they had a verdict. They had a 40-something million-dollar verdict. They very much wanted to hold on to their verdict. And tactically, the best way of holding on to their verdict was to be able to argue that only Suen had standing, that Quantum Merowet was not available, essentially, to Round Square. So if you look at the briefs, they specifically maintain they would be entitled to a retrial only on these issues, whether Suen and Roundtree were entitled to present their contract claims, but whether Suen was entitled to present his fraud and other claims. There was no request, explicit or implicit, by Roundtree to have this court mandate include a new trial on Roundtree's Quantum Merowet claim. At this point, the judge's unappealable decision was the law of the case.
Wasn't the order, though, silent after Suen won whether
which
the Round Square Quantum Merowet claim?
Which order, Your Honor?
In Suen won, the
order of the trial court?
Yes.
The trial court simply said that they were out of the case and the lawyers abandoned.
Well, I don't think it was that. I don't that simple that they were just out of it. I think we have to look at the specific language, and that's what I'm asking you to kind of drill down to take us one way or the other.
Right. Well, no, I think what happened is the judge ruled against Roundtree on the contract claim. At that point, the other side could easily have said, but we still have our quantum merit claim. But they abandoned that claim and constantly argued to the court, suing, 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 suing. The only one who has standing. If you don't give suing standing, no one will, quote, ever be able to collect. At this point, there was a final judgment. They brought their appeal, and their appeal explicitly abandoned any appeal from Roundtree's quantum merit judgment. Remember, we argued on the appeal that they didn't have, that Suen didn't have standing, and that the reason that you have standing is so important is standing precludes them from bringing another lawsuit on behalf of somebody else later on. Here's exactly what we said. Defendant will be protected against another suit brought by the real party in interest in the same matter. And, of course, that's precisely what's happened. Now they brought another lawsuit by the real party of interest, having abandoned that claim. They made a tactical decision on appeal to argue to this court that you must affirm the suing verdict, because if you don't, there will be no opportunity for anybody ever to collect. That was a tactical, willful, strategic judgment that binds them. And, of course, because they didn't make any argument to this court, this court's silence is the mandate. That is, this court did not remand the case for a retrial on Roundtree's quantum merit. That was the mandate of this case. And we cite numerous cases from around the country that says when an issue is willfully, tactically, deliberately waived on appeal, silence is the mandate. You don't expect the court to deal with issues that have been abandoned on appeal. Yet the second trial judge here erroneously ruled that Round Square's claim for quantum merit was properly before this court. And what it did is it looked at Your Honor's decision, but it totally mischaracterized it. Your Honor's decision dealt with Suen and his people in relationship to Suen and the contract and quantum merit claim. There was no discussion of Roundtree when it came to the quantum merit claim at all. And so this court, in an entirely separate section dealing with quantum merit, dealt with whether or not Suen had standing. And in that context, it said the efforts of the members of the group, etc., can be used in Suen's case, but not, of course, in the case of quantum merit for Round Square, which had abandoned it on appeal. Suen conceded, essentially, on appeal, that Round Square could not bring a quantum merit claim by arguing that his standing was the only one that could bring relief to the people who had worked under him. Now, as the federal...
Dershowitz, there's two areas that concern me about this Round Square argument that I'd like you to address. The first is procedural, and the other is has to do with trial by consent. As to the first question, I think you would acknowledge that there was never a written order on the part of the district court in dealing with Round Square's claim before the last appeal. So under our jurisprudence, an oral pronouncement of judgment isn't valid for any purpose, and as a consequence, the absence of a written judgment would prevent a resolution of that claim as to that party. And then the second question is whether the parties in the second trial essentially tried Round Square's quantum merit claim by consent.
Those are both key questions, obviously. As to the first question about a written order, the court couldn't have been clearer. The court said over and over again that quantum merit, that Roundtree is out of the case, is out of the case. At that point, the other side could easily have said, but what about Roundtree and quantum merit? They didn't do that. And they argued the case entirely in the first trial as if the judge had ruled clearly that Roundtree could get no relief. So that, in effect, constitutes the judgment of the court. And the judgment of the court was clearly reviewable and appealable. It would have been very simple.
Or an abandonment of the claim.
Well, they abandoned it, and they abandoned it for tactical reasons. And that gets to your second question, Your Honor. There's an enormous – the second trial, there was no consent to Roundtree being in the case on quantum Merowet. Lawyers said repeatedly that quantum Merowet was not in the case for Roundtree. That was clearly the argument that was made. If, in fact, there was any kind of a problem, it was just that they used the word plaintiffs instead of plaintiff. Now, that hardly constitutes a waiver of any kind in the combat of trial. What happened was, quite clearly, in the first case, there was a tactical, deliberate decision to abandon. In the second case, remember, Mr. Suen testified under oath, and he said, I am making a case for quantum Merowet and for contract. Roundtree is only making a case for contract. When you have the plaintiff making that argument under oath, it's very hard to say that the other side somehow consented to a trial of Roundtree and quantum Merowet. When the plaintiff himself says, we are not bringing a quantum Merowet case on behalf of Roundtree, that's the opposite of consent. It would be foolish at that point to belabor the record any further and go on and say again and again, we don't think that's in the case. It was
in jury
case.
Instruction 42, in addressing the elements of quantum Merowet, contemplate a quantum Merowet claim on behalf of both Suen and Round Square?
One can look and see and say perhaps that it could be interpreted that way, but not in the context of the case. When you have everybody saying quantum Merowet from Roundtree is out of the case, when you have the plaintiff himself, not even his lawyer, but the plaintiff conceding it, and the lawyer saying repeatedly that that's not in the case, it's awfully hard to have that resurrected by the instruction itself. And so, you know, I think, Your Honors, that in this case, if you look at the practicality of what was going on, practically what was going on was Suen was determined at the first appeal to maintain his $47 million verdict. And he thought the best way to do it would be to argue affirmatively that Roundtree had no quantum Merowet claim. That helped his argument. And what you don't want to do is have piecemeal litigation, as the 11th Circuit said. You don't reward an appellant for not having raised the argument. He shouldn't be in a better position than somebody who raised the argument and lost. And that's what would happen here. Not only that, but there'd be an inconsistency because they said, they represented to the court that if Suen doesn't win, there will be no recovery for anybody. Well, Suen didn't win. It went back to the trial. Suen lost on contract on quantum Merowet. Now, they're asking this court to do for them what they acknowledged they had no right to do and what they themselves abandoned. Your Honor, I know I only have a little bit of time, and I want to get to two other arguments very briefly. And one of them is very, very important. One is the instruction, the court pointed out, the instruction on quantum Merowet. And the instruction in this case allowed for a return no matter what value was given to the people in this case. In other words, it was quantum Merowet for effort, not for accomplishments. Indeed, under the instruction, which was objected to and which was inconsistent, we argue, with the mandate of this court, they could have given $100 million quantum Merowet even if the license had never been granted. And by the way, Your Honor, Sands never got a license. Never got a license. Another company got the license. They got a sub-license. If this was such an easy deal for fixed in Beijing that they would get the license, they would have gotten one of the three licenses. Wynn got one, Ho got one. The third one would have gone to Sands. The third one didn't go to Sands. Sands had to negotiate to get a sub-license from the licensee. And that brings us, Your Honor, to the last issue that I want to raise, and that is the court's total confusion between admissibility of evidence and the right to ask a key question on cross-examination. Mr. Suen testified, and this was key, that he accomplished through Beijing getting the license. And he said Beijing was putting pressure on him not to testify. And so the lawyer for Sands wanted to put to him the following question. Do you know that the Chinese Foreign Ministry issued a statement categorically denying that they had anything to do with the license being granted, that it was a completely domestic matter. The judge said, well, that's based on a newspaper article. Yeah, it was based on a Reuters report by three distinguished journalists quoting an official statement by the Foreign Ministry of China categorically denying what was the essential issue in this case. The judge said, well, it was an anonymous report. It was just issued from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Your Honor, the analogy would be this. Wolf Blitzer reports on CNN that he has called the White House and asked for a statement on whether or not the Iran deal is going to increase terrorism. And the White House issued a formal statement saying, no, the Iran deal would not contribute to terrorism. Would anybody in their right mind argue that that didn't constitute a sufficient basis for asking a question? The judge said it was inadmissible. The lawyer conceded it was inadmissible. It was hearsay. But hearsay can be used to cross-examine somebody. He would either answer the question yes or no. If he answered no, then our side conceded that there would be an instruction saying ignore the question.
Mr. Dershowitz, yes, let's say if we agreed with you that it was error by the judge to do that, is it harmful error sufficient to cause a reversal on that particular issue?
Henry, Your Honor, the key issue is whether or not Suen caused the license to be granted. This was the only categorical denial that it was not that way. You couple that with the issues that I don't have time to address, the hearsay issues, where the court allowed hearsay testimony that said that Ho told him, that told him, that told him, that maybe the people in Beijing heard, you would find the same thing you said in the first case, that without this evidence, there would be no connection, and you require a connection for quantum merit. So, Your Honor, yes, it would not be harmless error. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Dershowitz, before you sit down, going back to that instruction, would you just kind of in a nutshell the difference between what the court offered and what was proposed and not given?
Right. It's an excellent question. Your Honor, the key is whether or not you need to show that Sands actually received value benefit. And I think the difference is quite clear. The rejected instruction would have said that the jury has to find that services provided by the plaintiff conferred a benefit on Sands that was attributable to plaintiff's services. Instead, the instruction said that all they have to do is prove that they performed services of value. Now, obviously, if there's a meeting with the Chinese government, you're getting a service of value. My God, you get to meet with the Chinese government. Maybe they'll help you on something else. Maybe they'll get you good tickets to the Olympics. Maybe they'll do, who knows? But it was not tied to the specifics. And the basic contention in this case was we argued Suen did virtually nothing. Yes, maybe somebody on his behalf arranged the meeting in Beijing, but Beijing doesn't influence the way things happen in Macau. And so the jury, by this instruction that was rejected by us and accepted from the other side, told the jury they didn't have to consider that. All they had to do was ask, did they perform something of value rather than something that had a benefit to Sands? And, Your Honor, under the law of this state regarding quantum merit, particularly the restitutionary aspect of quantum merit, you have to show that direct connection. And most importantly, in this court's first opinion, when they reversed on the hearsay ground, finding it not to be harmless error, they said that that was crucial because without that, you wouldn't show the connection. And it was exactly that connection that the trial judge said you didn't have to find under the instruction. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. I think we're still in mourning, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. Todd Bice on behalf of Round Square. I first want to start with an observation that has been made fairly recently by both the Sixth and the Seventh Circuits, and I think the Sixth Circuit said it fairly well a few years back, is that when a party comes to us with nine grounds for reversing the district court's ruling, that usually means that there are none. And that is doubly the case with respect to Las Vegas Sands claims that Judge Baer committed 18 different errors. In reality, Judge Baer committed no errors. He was actually quite faithful to the law, fairly stringent with the evidence, and none of those rulings affected the substantial rights of Las Vegas Sands. This is the second time that Sands has come to the court asking to be relieved of a jury's determination that it asked for, received, and accepted substantial benefits of value for which it owes compensation. Neither one of those verdicts are particularly surprising, considering the evidence that came directly out of the mouths of Las Vegas Sands' own representatives on the witness stand, the first being Sheldon Adelson himself, who acknowledged, and as this court put in its first order, in Suen 1, acknowledged that he received substantial value, so much so that he offered an alternative form of payment because he claimed that he was concerned about the regulatory issues with paying a large lump sum for the benefits that they had received. The second came from Lenny Adelson, Mr. Adelson's own brother, who testified under oath, and the video was played to the jury, that his own brother told him that if we get this license, Lenny, you will have more money than you will know how to spend. And he did that because Lenny Adelson was responsible for introducing Round Square and Mr. Suen to Mr. Adelson. And then when the license was obtained and Lenny Adelson came to his brother and said, Mr. Sheldon, where's my compensation? Mr. Adelson didn't say, what are you talking about? He said, go talk to the Suen group. Bill Widener, the other Mr. Adelson's number two man at the time, also testified under oath in both trials that the obligation was there, the obligation was owed. He tried to couch it, however, in moral terms as opposed to legal ones, as though that would somehow sway the finder of fact as to what happened. And those, by the way, are just slivers of the evidence that the jury heard in this particular case. Let me turn to the argument now about this mandate and their assertion about the mandate rule somehow precluded Round Square, that they discovered after trying a case for 33 different days, they discovered that the claim that went to the jury wasn't even there. It wasn't even there. Sands is telling you one of two things. Sands is telling you that it either didn't see the issue at the time before until after the verdict happened, or it's telling you that, well, we saw the issue, but we decided to lie in wait and see what the jury did. Either one of those answers, one of those is true, either one of them is unacceptable and serves as no basis for challenging a jury's verdict. What we are now seeing is, and as Judge Baer laid out in detail in a written order, is that this is an argument that was contrived after the jury's verdict, that this case was tried with them, with knowledge of the case, in their own jury instructions, in their own special verdict form, acknowledging repeatedly that Round Square had a quantum merit claim to assert and that it was tried knowingly with consent. That is a matter that rests soundly within the trial judge's discretion, and Judge Baer laid out in a detailed order how that happened and why that happened. The mandate rule, as this court has articulated, is it addresses and controls matters once the appellate court decides a question of law, it is binding on the parties as well as the district court upon any subsequent retrial. That is what the mandate rule is under Nevada law. That comes from Justice Hardesty's decision in Dichter. And the point being is that if an issue is not decided and not addressed by the court, it does not become part of the mandate. This court has said that repeatedly. You heard a contradictory argument from Las Vegas Sands. The first argument is that we didn't appeal. There was an order out there somewhere. They can't identify it for you. There's an order out there that we somehow didn't appeal. Then they, because they say that the district judge, Judge Leavitt at that point in time, disposed of the claim. But then they turn around and say, but we then abandoned the claim. Well, which version is it that you're advancing? Did the trial judge rule on this claim or not? Number one, and if so, where is the order? What we know happened was, as the record makes this clear, is that the trial judge entered a summary judgment ruling on the express contract claim. And the trial judge treated any other claims being quasi-contract, implied contract, as being joined and rising and falling with that claim. The only order that they can point to, that they claim somehow addressed this issue, is the order that we appealed and the order that was reversed in its entirety by this court.
Mr. Biceworth,
yes,
because the order, at least the order I have in front of me, dated April 4th, 2008, indicates that Las Vegas Sands, Inc. has awarded partial summary judgment dismissing plaintiff Richard Suen and Round Square Companies Limited first and second claims for relief with prejudice. So we had other claims that were not?
That we have other claims that were, there was no motion made by them on that, on the quantum Merowit claim, but the trial judge, Judge Leavitt, treated that claim.
Did we have other claims asserted in the pleadings? Were there more than one and two?
Yes, there were other claims asserted in the pleadings. There was an additional claim for quantum Merowit asserted in the pleadings. And what Sands really is arguing here, but doesn't seem to want to use the words, is what they're arguing is waiver. We waive the claim because we chose not to present it to the jury, and we chose not to, although we've made that clear in the record, and I would point out in the record that my colleague, Mr. Pizzanelli, had made the point when jury instructions during the first trial were being hammered out that we specifically were not abandoning that issue. But nonetheless, that was the Judge Leavitt's ruling. But if it is a theory of waiver that they are seemingly advancing, waiver as itself can be waived. There's no mandate that precludes that claim from being asserted in a subsequent trial. The mandate does not bar parties from amending their complaint upon a retrial and adding entirely new claims as long as they are not foreclosed expressly or by necessary implication from the mandate or from this court's ruling. And there is nothing in this court's ruling, and they concede that there is nothing in this court's ruling that precluded Mr. Round Square from asserting and trying the claim for quantum Merowit. And that is what happened here. And if Las Vegas Sands is telling you that they did not believe that there was a quantum Merowit claim for Round Square, they are being extraordinarily unfaithful to the record. The trial judge, everyone that was participating in this, Suen, Round Square, Las Vegas Sands, and the trial judge all acknowledged that Round Square had a quantum Merowit claim to go to the trial. It was in Las Vegas Sands' own jury instructions. They had told you in their brief that, well, that was only after the trial judge had disposed of their Rule 50 motion. That was simply not true. Those jury instructions were submitted long before that issue, and they acknowledged that the claim was there. It was in their own special verdict form that Round Square had such a claim. And that is why, when this issue was raised for the first time, as Judge Baer found, the first time these words mandate, law of the case, were ever uttered by Las Vegas Sands was in its renewed Rule 50 motion after they had lost the jury verdict. That is the first time those words were ever uttered by them because it was an argument advanced for the first time after they lost. And as Judge Baer said, Rule 50 does not allow you to do that because as I indicated to you, one of two things happened here. They either didn't see the issue that they wanted to argue before the jury's verdict, or they saw it and they laid in wait. Either one of those is unacceptable. Rule 50 precludes either of those arguments. Then we point out is that Las Vegas Sands submitted all this material to the jury, or to the district court judge, never made any arguments as Rule 50 would require it, and as this court knows, and as this court has repeatedly held, Rule 50 requires a specific reservation and preservation of the issue by express motion, and if it is not raised, it is forever waived. It is ironic that we are hearing Las Vegas Sands talk about waiver, because if anyone committed a waiver here, it is by definition Las Vegas Sands, as the trial judge found, and is well within the trial judge's discretion, and it cannot be suggested seriously that the trial judge abused its discretion in the light of all of the evidence, trying a case for 33 days, having an adverse jury verdict come back, and then hearing for the first time an argument that we, Las Vegas Sands, have just realized now that a case that we tried wasn't properly even before the jury because it was somehow foreclosed by this court's ruling. What Judge Leavitt had done is she had linked all those claims involving Round Square contract, whether express, implied, quasi, duty of good faith and fair dealing, rightly or wrongly, she linked them all together. And as recall, in your first ruling, you specifically said her decision granting summary judgment was improper because she essentially made findings of fact that Las Vegas Sands thought it was dealing only with Suen and not with Round Square.
Mr. Pice, could I interrupt you?
Yes, Justice Hardesty.
There's a few other issues that I think are important. So assuming for the moment that the court would credit your argument that Round Square could recover in quantum merit.
Yes.
Can they recover for the services provided by Choi and Sue? I wanted to ask you first that generally, but as part of your response, clarify their testimony as to what they understood about either being compensated generally or simply receiving expenses from Mr. Suen.
Okay.
And then secondly, was it necessary for Round Square to establish an agency relationship between itself and Choi and Sue in order to recover for the value of the services that they rendered? And as part of that, I'm sorry for the length of this question, but as part of that, on page 6 of the remand order, when evaluating whether Sue could recover, whether Suen could recover on behalf of its associates, Choi and Zhu, if I pronounce that correctly, and if I haven't, I apologize. The court evaluated two cases, Romy Hames and Morrow, in saying that Suen could recover for the individual efforts of each member of the group. So the question then would be, can Round Square do so, where the relationship between Round Square and those two individuals is less clear?
Justice Hardesty,
sorry for the length of question. We're running out of time here, and I think those are important issues.
I'm going to try and answer the question in the chronology that I've made the notes. The answer to your question about was there an expectation of compensation on behalf of Choi and Zhu, the answer is yes, and in fact, Mr. Suen testified at trial that he had reached an agreement with them on the manner in which they would be compensated for that. And let's not forget, Mr. Adelson himself, when he was talking to his own brother and was talking about how he would be compensated, because he is the one who made the introduction, Mr. Adelson pointed his own brother to the Suen team to look to them for compensation. So, yes, there was an expectation, and that is consistent with Mr. Suen's testimony to the jury. Second of all, you raised this question, Your Honor, when during Suen 1, we were talking about an individual only because the district judge had treated Round Square as being completely out of the case. When you're dealing with legal entities, as the court knows, can only act through officers, directors, employees, and agents. They are the arms and hands of a legal entity. There is no requirement, although Las Vegas Sands tries to impose one that I would submit has never been heard of before, certainly in any decisions of this court, that in order to establish an agency relationship with a legal entity, that legal entity must present either express written contracts into evidence or somehow pay stubs or other somehow formal proof of an agency relationship. But that's not what this court said in Romy Hames. In fact, remember, Romy Hames, the president of the contract contractor in that case, was allowed to testify that the work was done by the company and the company's representatives at the express direction of the client in that case. And this court said that testimony in and of itself was sufficient to establish the basis for the quantum merit claim. In this particular case, we have not only did we have Mr. Suen testifying, we had all of the faxes, they were still using faxes in that era, came from Round Square. The business cards were in the name of Round Square. The telephone lines that were used both for communications and for faxes were Round Square's telephone. The email address where they did communicate via email was Round Square. The letterhead of the offers back and forth about what the compensation would be for the services were on round square letterhead. That's why this court originally reversed Judge Leavitt's ruling, that's where she had concluded that Las Vegas Sands didn't think it was dealing with round square, because as this court said, that is a question of fact for the jury to have to determine. And that's exactly what happened here. The jury did determine it. They heard Mr. Suen's testimony, including the fact that Mr. Suen had testified that Round Square is who compensated Choi and Zhu for reimbursed their expenses. Of course, it would only be doing that if they were acting as agents on behalf of Round Square. And Las Vegas Sands knew that it was dealing with Round Square from all of the evidence as a whole. And last but not least, under the law, if there are questions of fact, competing inferences that can be drawn from the facts about for whom these people were acting, that's a question for the jury to decide. And that question was presented to the jury to make the determination of were they acting on behalf of Mr. Suen in his individual capacity, or were they acting on behalf of Round Square as an entity of which Mr. Suen acting as a director. They made the determination that that's how they were acting, and the evidence amply supports that. Now, let's remember something, because they've made this argument that, well, in the first appeal, we were only talking about Suen. That's right, we were, because the trial judge did not allow us to present the entire picture of the relationship between these parties and Round Square. The second trial and the second jury is the only jury that heard the entirety of the story about Round Square's involvement in this and the role that it played. And the second jury was certainly entitled, after hearing all that evidence, to conclude these individuals were acting on behalf of Round Square as its agents under Mr. Suen's direction as a director of Round Square, and thus were entitled to seek compensation. Round Square was entitled to be compensated for the services that were rendered. Let me make one final observation, because we heard about the jury instruction. I would remind this court, it is ironic that I'm hearing Las Vegas Sands talking about waiver. This is the exact same jury instruction that was given in the first trial that they had no issues with. The reason that this instruction was given is because, as Judge Baer put in the record, this is the instruction that was given during the first trial. They never complained about this during the first appeal. They never said that was error, there was a fault with that instruction. They agreed to that instruction and never came to you and said that there was a problem with it. Then they come back for the second trial and now want to quarrel with the jury instruction, and the jury instruction is a fair and neutral statement of the law. One of the things that the court looks at all of the proposed jury instructions from Las Vegas Sands, and this was a recurring theme, their jury instructions, 7 times out of 10, were advocacy pieces, written to advance their argument and to ask Judge Baer to put his stamp, the court's stamp, on the arguments that they were making. And that was equally true with respect to their arguments about quantum merit. They proposed instructions such as the jury had to consider just what people would be paid on an hourly basis and get the court to stamp that as the court instructing the jury, you must accept that as the measure of damages for quantum merit. That's not the law. What the jury instruction here provided is that the jury is supposed to determine whether or not services, and again, you don't interpret these instructions in isolation, they're supposed to determine whether or not they rendered services of value to Las Vegas Sands. That is, by definition, the measure of the benefit that they received. They were permitted to argue and did argue what that number should have been.
So before you conclude your arguments, could you address whether the testimony offered on behalf of Round Square and Suen in support of its damage claim was a value for services rendered measure of damages, or instead represented a benefit of bargain based upon the calculations that were made under the anticipated agreement for compensation?
Justice Hardesty, I don't recognize those as somehow being separate and distinct from each other, because I would answer the question as simple as this. Who would know better than the value and the benefit received than Sheldon Adelson? As Sheldon Adelson admitted, and the jury knows this, that they receive substantial benefits, substantial value, whatever word one wants to attach to it, such that he offered the procurement deal, arguing that that he didn't want to have to pay it up front due to regulatory issues, unidentified regulatory issues, and that it was worth $100 million. The chairman of the company knew full well the benefit he received and the value of the services that had been rendered, which is why he, after they obtained the license, proposed the alternative form of payment. That fact in and of itself is an admission that the jury was entitled to consider, just like Mr. Adelson's own admission to his brother the jury was entitled to consider, just like William Widener's admission, although he tried to couch it as a moral obligation to pay as opposed to a legal one. The jury was entitled to hold, to take Mr. Adelson's word from both himself, his brother, and his number two man, William Widener, as being true and accept it, and thus award a quantum merit recovery to Round Square, which is what they did. Both juries recognized the extraordinary value in this, as did Mr. Adelson, which is why he offered the alternative form of payment.
Chief, could I ask one more question?
Certainly.
Okay. Mr. Bice, I'd just like your response to Mr. Dershowitz's comments about the question the judge precluded the attorney for Las Vegas Sands answering about the response of the Chinese government regarding the licensing.
I'll give Professor Dershowitz credit for trying to be creative, but his assertion that somehow a lawyer is permitted to ask a question that is unquestionably a hearsay question. He's trying to interject hearsay into the record through a question is somehow appropriate when it is not. He had a newspaper article that had allegedly, there's no evidence of this anywhere, that any formal government agency had issued anything. He had a newspaper article that said that some unidentified spokesman or unidentified person had said something. That person wasn't on the stand. He wasn't a subject to cross-examination. No one even knew his name. And they tried, what they were seeking to do, was trying to introduce hearsay in the form of a question inappropriately, and Judge Baer said, that's not acceptable. You do not get to interject hearsay under the guise of a question. Because you, by the way, you, as a lawyer, you have to have a good faith basis for claiming that you have admissible evidence to back up that question. And they had none. And Judge Baer said that.
If the lawyer's question itself is not hearsay, it's the answer it would be the hearsay. How would you distinguish that?
I would agree with you, Justice Gibbons, that a lawyer's question, but you have to have a basis for the question that has got to be in the form of what you reasonably believe is admissible evidence. You cannot come into the court and just simply say, well, is it possible that so-and-so said this? Did you know that Mr. Adelson, or did you know that the premier of China said that Mr. Adelson didn't know anything on this contract? That's essentially what they were trying to introduce under the guise of a question. And that is not an appropriate question. And it was being brought in, as Judge Baer recognized, to try and introduce, under the guise of a question, hearsay. And interjected into the record.
Great.
And if, just to finish this point because you raised it, even if they should have been allowed to ask such an inappropriate question, you seriously cannot contend that an unanswered question materially impacted your substantive rights, your substantial rights, that somehow now a second jury verdict, a second jury determination that they owed substantial monies for the substantial benefits they received should somehow be thrown out. I thank the court for its time.
All right. Colleagues, any other questions? Nope. Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, there is no authority anywhere in the English-speaking or Western world for the proposition that you must ask a question based on, quote, admissible evidence. That is simply a misstatement of the law. And I ask the other side to please submit a letter to this court citing any authority that a question must be based on admissible evidence. There simply is no such authority. Now, the court asked for evidence or issues regarding waiver. At the trial itself, the second trial, on page 7114 of the joint appendix, here's what our lawyer said. Quote, Roundtree is not part of the quantum Marowak claim. That's not abandonment. That's not waiver. That's not conceding. That was argued, and it was based on Mr. Suen's own testimony. that Quantum Merowet by Roundtree was not part of the claim. Now, I want to address myself to what Judge Hardesty asked, because it's the key question in terms of issue of whether or not Quantum Merowet is applicable to Roundtree. Your Honor asked some very probing questions. Those questions should have been asked on the first appeal. On the first appeal, they should have argued that Roundtree had standing to collect for the work of the people. That should have been raised on the first appeal. That's the decision they refused to make. And that's why not only they waive it, not only they abandon it. They said they abandoned it because the trial judge ruled against them. When the trial judge rules against you, you don't abandon an argument on appeal. You raise that argument on appeal. By not raising that argument on appeal, they present it to you now. That's piecemeal litigation. That's rewarding them for not raising it the first time on appeal. Had they raised it the first time on appeal, you might very well have ruled against them. You might have held, as the law says, the burden of proof is on them to show agency. Sewin couldn't have been an agent. The court ruled against, the jury ruled against him. And also, a manager is not an agent, or a member, a director is not an agent. The others, Sewin testified there was no contract. There was only a moral duty, a duty of honor. And so, Your Honors, just one more point about the procurement deal. They argue that the key issue is that Mr. Adelson was willing to have a procurement deal. You have to work for it. You're not given $100 million. You have to work. You have to earn it. In fact, the offer was, we'll give you the procurement deal. They came back and said, give us a minimum of $25 million. And Mr. Adelson said, no, you have to earn it. So that by itself, the recognition that you can have an opportunity to earn the money back because maybe you made some introductions, is certainly far short of a concession. So, Your Honor, I think, again, looking at the way these trials were tried practically, they abandoned their argument. They abandoned it on appeal. They're asking for a second shot. There is no waiver principle. The courts have said, even at the joint request of the litigants, the district court may not deviate from the mandate of an appellate court. So even if this court were to find that the silence allowed the trial to go forward, the court simply had no jurisdiction to consider Quantum Merowet by Round Square because that issue was tactically, deliberately, willfully waived on appeal in order to maximize their chances of winning the first appeal. They lost the first appeal. They came back and did exactly what they said they wouldn't do, asked for Quantum Merowet on somebody other than Sewin. That is totally inconsistent with what they represented to the court. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
All right, colleagues, any other questions? No? All right, counsel, thank you very much for the arguments and the briefing in this case. The case will stand submitted.